Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope you guys had an awesome Thanksgiving weekend. Sagar and I hope you stayed safe. We had a great time with our friends and family, obviously in a socially distanced way, but we dropped two huge episodes, Scott Gallo and Andrew Sullivan, during that week. So if you missed them because of the holiday, definitely check them out.
That's right. And do not forget, everybody, we just launched a newsletter on Substack. You're going to follow the link in the episode description or notes. Go to realignment.substack.com. It's going out every Friday. Now, look, what we are trying to build out is what more of what we do here. We're going to have more featured Q&A. We're going to have shorter and longer takes. We're going to have transcripts. And definitely leave us a note, too, at realignmentpod@gmail.com. Or just leave a comment on the Substack site with any suggestions. We're really trying to build out a place for the community of The Realignment. And most importantly, we are going to be putting our book recommendations, Marshall. I mean, both of us read so many books, and we feature so many of our favorite authors here on the podcast. We figured out a way that we can help out everybody going forward.
Yeah, and something I liked about the first issue was people send us long emails in a good way. Nothing weird, nothing creepy, except for that random Epstein thing back in September. But all that being said, the long emails are really appreciated, but it's sometimes hard to read them out over the air and then respond to them. So something I did this week was I featured the full question with a bunch of critiques of the Scott Galloway episode. We're going to get into it this episode because this is a Q&A show. However, we really want to get your long form thoughts. We'll put them in the newsletter. People could discuss it in the comments. That will be really cool.
And a quick thing, a special shout out to the Lincoln Network, the sponsor of this podcast. Note that I said Lincoln Network, not the Lincoln Project, people. Really, I want to know, anybody out there, do any of you people think that I would ever work for the Lincoln Project or take those people's money? I mean, honestly, like, come on. But regardless, I'm insulted that you even had to ask. So a special shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast.
And just the most important thing to know is that there is no world where the Lincoln Project would even give us money. This isn't a situation where we could say humbly, we're rejecting your funds. No, like this wouldn't happen at all. And it's really frustrating. We're mostly kidding here, but it's frustrating how people seem to sort of be so bad faith. They can't even come after us in a smart or intelligent way. That's my favorite part.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, they're not given, we're not taken. We're all good here. We've got the Lincoln Network, who is the sponsor of this podcast, and we're very happy because they let us say whatever we want. So thank you, Lincoln Network. And with that, we have some realignment questions. One of my favorite things that we get to do here is when we do our monthly realignment cues episode. So Marshall, what do we got?
Just a reminder, the way this works is you can leave us a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts with your questions, or you can email us a question at realignmentpod@gmail.com. A couple of you are asking in the YouTube comments how you ask a question if you're not on Apple Podcasts. This is the way you do it. Send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or you could even leave us a reply to the new Substack once you subscribe. On to the first question with the very, very creative name of 420 for Sagar, obviously a longtime listener. Hi, I'm a longtime riser and newfound realigner. I worked closely with the 2016 Bernie campaign, but have become much more attracted to conservatism recently. I recently had an interview on the radio about ticket splitting. It was rusty. How do you get better at those sort of short segments? As much as I hate them, they're a huge part of getting our message out there.
So it's an interesting question, and I think what you're really asking me is about how you get your point across in a short segment. The toughest thing that I have to do is, as a person who loves long-form content, love doing this podcast, love doing Rising, I get to talk for like 3 hours a day whenever we do this stuff, is sometimes I have to go on cable and you have to make a point within 2 to 3 minutes. So the crux of what I always teach people who have to go on cable news, when you get 1 minute, 2 minute, or whatever, is what is the key thing that you're trying to say? So what you're trying to say is about ticket splitting. What you're really trying to come across, I think, is that people have priorities that cross boundaries, right? So what you're trying to get across is that some people might value divided government. Some people might value one candidate or the other that has nothing to do with the R or the D next to their name, but with the actual policies that they are promoting. There you go. I just gave you like a minute and a half answer to your first question, but I completely understand. Doing radio and doing cable television without being able to talk and really make your point for a long time is really hard. Try and boil it down and distill it. One of the most important things that I learned as a journalist was writing headlines. And this is something a lot of journalists don't actually get to learn. But what you do is it teaches you to think about the crux of your story. What are you trying to get across? And that is something that I would encourage you to do if you're out there and trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, a couple points here. One, this was something that I had to learn the hard way. Know what you are going to say before you go on your hit. A lot of us like to come on.
Wait, sort explain of what a hit is. Explain what a hit is.
Yeah. So we're not even inside baseball-y. Before you go on to your TV appearance, radio appearance, shorthand hit, know what you are going to say. I had to learn this the hard way because I went on Rising for the first time and I sort of thought that Rising is a place where you could just sort of talk. You asked me something and I just sort of started talking about, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, no, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. You should know what you are trying to say. It's really important to realize, especially in short form mediums, you're not actually having a conversation. You're not actually discoursing with someone. You're trying to get a message across in a succinct manner. The other thing that I think about a lot is this isn't even contained to the short form. Oftentimes, people who see longer formats, whether it's a sort of 30-minute show or an hour-long show or even sort of Rogan, they see those longer formats and they think you can just discourse and go as long as you want. However, what's actually true is that you should always be succinct in a conversational manner. A good example of this is I used to work at PBS on the reboot of Firing Line. We had a very prominent general who worked in the Afghan conflict, and he was asked the following question. What do you think of the U.S. experience in Afghanistan? Now, he could have given a good answer that was 10 to 15 seconds. We've been there for 20 years. It's a tough commitment, but I think we should recognize that this is a strong priority for the American people. That's not my politics, but that's a short, succinct answer that could have started a good conversation. Instead, this general, who also has a PhD, decided to give us a 2-minute discourse on what we see if this goes back to the 1860s with the British. And then in 1965, that's not actually succinct. It doesn't actually make you sound smart because you're not able to deliver your message succinctly. So no matter where you're doing, really think of what you're trying to say and say it shorter. Almost always, if you have to ask yourself if you're going too long, you're going too long.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, sometimes I give you an answer, it's too long, it's meandering, it doesn't make any sense, and I re-record an answer because your time is precious to me, and that's something that you should always remember whenever you have somebody's attention, is it's your responsibility to keep them captivated, to keep them informed in the amount of time that they feel comfortable with, not you. All right, next question. This is from Stinette15. Hey guys, I wanted to ask a sort of two-part question that goes to the question that you had with Anna. In undergrad, I had a professor that almost religiously taught from The American Voter and subsequent sequels to it. I have many problems with the conclusion that the book comes to, but as to the relevant parts, what is your take on the idea that American voters vote wrong based on their individual needs? The assumption being that the lower economic classes tend to vote for conservative economic policies when progressive economic policies would be, quote, better for them. Without getting into laissez-faire versus Keynesian discussion, isn't the assumption that people vote solely on the basis of economic policy wrong? Wow, that's a great question. Marshall, what do you think?
Yeah, it's entirely wrong. Obviously, people vote not just lower class, but even upper class. If everyone was voting purely on the economic interests, you'd have a bunch of Democrats voting for tax cuts. And Joe Biden is telling his upper middle class voters, I'm probably going to raise your taxes. So obviously you see people on the left and the right voting on issues that aren't just about economics. The other thing we should recognize is that at this stage of society that we live in, obviously there's high degrees of poverty. Obviously there's always different situations that you and I have been lucky not to experience. But for the mass majority of us, we are not living from meal to meal. We're not living in poverty. So we start to have different hierarchies of needs that are moving from beyond just survival. So we're going to maybe vote on economics. You're maybe going to vote for repealing the SALT tax. But at the same time, you're going to care about LGBT issues. You're going to care about immigration policy from a cultural perspective. You're going to care about the way your city works. There are going to be deeper issues that aren't just purely based on economics. And it's also deeply condescending to conclude that any group of people are voting the wrong way as if you can make that judgment for someone else.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to get across. Nothing I despise more than people are like, look at these poor people voting against their interests. And it's like, well, maybe their interest is that they want to live their lives untainted by woke ideology or by being told that they're completely wrong and complete rubes. Like, maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe they just want to feel respected and that they're not even going to listen to something that you say unless somebody at least tries to meet you where you are. Here's the thing about Trump. He, at the very least, he never tried to lecture down to people. And I think that that was one of the most underrated parts of his success in American politics. And look, I mean, I had to grapple a lot with this, with the 2020 election results, which is that if you had asked me before the 2020 election results, you're like, how much of Trumpism is culture and how much is economics? I probably would have told you 60-40, 60 culture, 40 economics. Here's the truth. He didn't run as much populist Republican, and he won more votes in 2020. So what does that mean? It means that culture may be like 80. It may be like 85. And there's nothing wrong with that, which is that if Americans feel that their culture is under such attack that they're willing to vote for somebody in order to protect it, that's okay. That's on them. I just think that it's so insulting and condescending for people to lecture others and say, you need to care about X. Well, convince them, and convince them in the language that they speak, because otherwise, nothing's ever going to happen.
Quick pushback, though, which is that I agree with your point about not being condescending. And if we're looking at why Joe Biden was a good candidate for Democrats, no one would really accuse Biden of being condescending in many respects. So that's why he was actually a good match for Trump, obviously. But I think we could acknowledge that while also recognizing that if we only vote on cultural issues and we're pointing out things that are very important, that also isn't a good thing. It's more about balance and pragmatism.
100%.
My objection to the idea of voting wrong is the idea that it's empirically provable that this is the right exact set of policies for Sagar and Jetty, or that this is exactly the way that Marshall is sort of voting and that emotion plays no role in it. I object to that part, but I do think that a world where everyone was only voting on culture issues, only on red-blue issues, only on rural versus urban divides, that obviously would be a disaster for the country. So I think we have to balance that.
Look, there's no disagreement here. I'm not a culture war guy, right? Like, I wouldn't consider that what I do or am most interested in. That's not what we talk about here on this podcast or on the show Rising. And I agree, it's a disaster. But we have to try and understand why people vote and exactly what motivates them in the chief way whenever they go to the ballot box. And one thing, an interesting and fine take that I saw was, if you care about many of these economic positions that we have here, then you also have to understand that cultural aspect and that a fusion of trying to solve and move past our problems lies somewhere there in the middle. There isn't a politician really in America who wants to try and recognize the potency of both. But until that time, there's not much we can do. Okay, now on to the second part of the question. Why do a lot of people still categorize the U.S. by regions, i.e. the South, when it seems that the only material factor that matters is population and culture? Cities like New Orleans, Birmingham, Montgomery, Atlanta, etc. are all overwhelmingly blue, yet they are in the heart of the Deep South. Can we all not agree that the political ideological divide is now urban versus rural and not a southern versus northern one? Thanks. Love the show. What do you think, Marshall?
What's interesting about that is both points are sort of true. So for example, yes, in New Orleans, Birmingham, Montgomery, Atlanta, the cities listed, they are blue cities. Increasingly, and we're talking about a realignment here, the urban-rural divide is a central factor in American politics. At the same time, though, most of those states still go red. So the North-South dynamic is still relevant to me in this context, because what it suggests to me is that in red southern states, except for Georgia in the 2020 election, the geography still overwhelms the urban-rural divide. In contrast to a state like California, where you see the cities being overwhelmingly blue and the rural parts overwhelmingly red, in that part of the country, the rural people can't overwhelm the urban vote. So that dynamic still matters. I can't think of a single northern/western state where rural parts of the state would actually be able to overwhelm the urban ones.
Pennsylvania is the only one that you might want to include in that, because it's the only actual swing state there in the Northeast. But yeah, look, you're completely correct, which is geography trumps the underlying dynamics, but the underlying dynamics are very important and, as we learned in 2020, can eventually come and overcome geography. So what happened, right, in 2020, which is that Georgia went blue because of the suburbs in Atlanta. Arizona went blue because of the suburban population of Maricopa County. So in terms of where things are converging, I think you're directionally correct, but not thinking about geography would also be dumb, right? Because I foresee a future in which Texas, my own home state, let's take that for example. I'm not going to say it's blue. It's blue. It's like purple-ish. I think it'll stay Republican for quite a long time, especially given the 2020 results. But the politics within those states are going to change in order just to adapt to the millions of new California and New York voters. And hey, look, that could just look completely different. That could mean a less populous GOP because you have higher income voters that are coming to the state and maybe they get absorbed into it. Whereas you might see other states, which the downward trajectory in class may begin to become more populous themselves. This is kind of a story of somewhere like Ohio, which is losing population. So this is a dynamic where it's important to keep both geography and class in mind and see where things are beginning to trend.
Great question. This is from Tyler. Is there any room for Biden voters in the new right? I can't sort through the thought process of someone in the new right voting for Biden, as he is the epitome of the globalist establishment, but I'm open to being wrong. I can imagine a new right voter voting against Trump if it was someone like Andrew Yang or Tulsi Gabbard in the opposition, but the Biden-Clinton-Obama framework and the new right seem completely antithetical to me. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, I largely think it's probably antithetical. And look, we are not spokespeople for the new right. I, at this point, barely even believe the new right exists as a viable political project. So let me put that, all my cards there on the table.
Sagar, you just buried the lead there. What do you mean by that?
Okay, look, I mean, this is, the 2020 results had a profound impact on me. Like I said, I mean, if you'd asked me before, I would have said Trumpism 60-40, culture, economics. Here's the truth. I think 85-15. I don't think that I think that 15% is still vital to a 2016 Trump election, but this actually comes from a guy named Aaron Sabarium. He wrote a good essay over at American Compass, which is run by Orrin Cass, friend of the show, where he talked about, look, if long as the left continues to move more leftward on cultural issues, the right can actually stop realigning itself along economic issues and simply serve as a bulwark to the cultural left, which is generally a majoritarian position when you begin to dig down into it, and you can actually win elections on that. And this is the culture war kind of deterministic framework that I do not like, I am not a proponent of, but I think is the reality of the situation. Now, all of that being said, the best argument that I saw from new right, maybe take Andrew Sullivan, for example. I would put him more like as a new right figure. He basically came out that way in our episode. Is he was like, look, I just hate Trump. And I thought that Biden might be able to cool down the ideological craziness that's going on the left, and which is then spurring reactionary backlash on the right. That's probably the best case. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Same thing whenever it comes to the pandemic. I mean, Julius Krein, who is a, you know, quote-unquote new right leader over at American Affairs, he was like, yeah, I think there's probably more opening for industrial policy in a Biden administration than a Trump administration. That's a correct policy framework in order to take. I mean, let's be empirically honest here, kind of about who and exactly what happened during the Trump administration. So those are the two best arguments that I saw.
The funny thing about this is, despite Tyler's point, I think it's pretty easy to imagine a lot of people voting against Trump, and that explains why he lost, in the sense that Trump is Trump, and there are plenty of legitimate reasons to think that Trump is a bad president and that he personally doesn't advance the causes that you care about. That's sort of the problem here. If we're sort of looking at the dream new right populist policy platform, it's sitting on a table. Yeah, it'd be hard to see someone voting for Joe Biden in that context, but politics comes down to the personalities here. So it'd be very easy to see that dynamic going on. I also just want to do a quick note. I'm really fascinated by the way that a lot of people bracket Andrew Yang and Tulsi Gabbard into the quote-unquote new right slash populist space. Well, I just don't think that's true. people like their aesthetics, and we sort of talked about this before. They like how Tulsi goes against the Democratic Party establishment. They like how Andrew Yang doesn't look or behave like a traditional politician, but there's nothing right about them other than Tulsi's foreign policy stance. But if you're actually looking at the policies she believes in, she's pretty progressive on domestic policy. She's obviously socially liberal in the ways that the Democratic Party expects you to be. So I just want to sort of ask people, what are you really saying when you're saying the new right is open to Tulsi or open to Andrew? Because I just don't think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think people confuse appreciation with being in the same side. Like, I can appreciate Andrew Yang, but I also know that Andrew Yang is like a leftist. And there's nothing wrong with that, but he is, and that's okay. He had a large crossover amongst Trump voters. I completely understand that, and largely because Andrew was probably most analogous to Trump in terms of the message when we were talking about economics. But look, culture matters, and I want to hammer that home, and I'm probably overdoing it here today, but it was a profound lesson for me from the 2020 election, and I hope everybody carries that forward.
You said something interesting. I wouldn't call Andrew Yang a leftist. If we're getting to why he appeals to people, it's that his politics, while center-left, they're sort of amorphous. He talks about tech and UBI, but he also is uncomfortable with the establishment. How would you sort of describe that? Because I just wouldn't call that leftist.
Yeah, maybe I used the wrong terminology. I meant just like he's a cultural liberal, right? And like he wants to use economic policy in order to advance culturally liberal ends. Fine. Again, no worries. Totally legitimate. But let's be honest here about what is being maximized, right? Like the core of Yang's UBI and more is like, you know, people are like, oh, you can use it to buy weed, or like, oh, like now like I can go and be like a painter or whatever. And like, I'm much more interested in how people creating families and working in productive industries and, you know, working towards a national end. And that's not really what Andrew Yang is all about. He can appreciate it, and it's totally fine. And maybe you would say, Sagar, in order to get the things that you want, this is the best policy. I accept that. I don't reject that, but I think it's a fair argument. But that's what I mean whenever I say it.
Are there no painters in Sagar's America?
Huh? Not too many. Okay. Yeah.
Not subsidized by the state.
Yeah,
is the
not
key
subsidized by the state. I can tell you that. Unless it's like Michelangelo or something like that. Somebody's going to throw like Leonardo da Vinci at me. But hey, look, there's a difference between Michelangelo and like Banksy. All right. So next question. Dhruv from London. I wanted to ask what you think needs to be done reforming campaign finance in America, other than the repeal of Citizens United. I'm based in London, but take an interest nonetheless. Would a flat, regular payment from the government to all citizens ring-fenced for the purposes of grassroots-style campaign contributions be worthwhile? I'd love to get your thoughts on that on the podcast. What do you think, Marshall?
One of my most contrarian takes is campaign finance. Larry Lessig, who's at Harvard and is very aggressive on the need for campaign finance reform, put this in a way that is very helpful for me, which is that his concern isn't really with the amount of money in American politics, because that's the way you see this issue framed as, which is people spent all this money or this campaign raised all this money and that's sort of bad. That doesn't seem to me to be the problem. The example we brought up was that Americans spend more on Halloween candy, potato chips, basically any commodity product than they spend on elections. So it's unclear to me that it's bad that we spend a lot of money on something that's incredibly important. The way that he delineates it is that the way we raise money is a problem. So he thinks that it's a problem that a congressman or woman will spend 70% of their time on the phone raising money instead of actually working on the issues. So that's my first sort of delineation there, because too often it just gets into this comment about how much money is spent. But to the actual idea of a flat, regular payment, I mean, it seems fine, but to me, the issue seems to be that the Supreme Court has ruled, and I think rightfully so, that the government can't restrict anyone from spending their own money or as much money as they want on a campaign. So sure, we could have a world where every American got a $50 voucher that they could spend on campaigns, but it's still probable that people would still raise money from other sources and they could even spend their own money. You see, that's why a lot of wealthy people are in politics in the first place. So I just don't know materially what difference that would do. I guess the one good thing that would come from a system like that is that it would probably encourage people to believe and know that they have input in the system and would incentivize politicians to raise money from different areas. So that could be fine, but I don't think that's going to be a game changer in any broad sense of the term if you think there's a deep problem of corruption in our politics.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think democracy dollars is an interesting idea. But what you're complaining about, what people are complaining about when they talk about money in politics, is not about Citizens United. It's not about the ability to spend. It's about the distribution of capital, number one. And number two, it's about our legislative process. That's what you're actually complaining about. You're much more complaining. I wouldn't even say that money in politics is the problem. I would say that the pipelines through which policy is made is the biggest problem. And by the way, they spend a lot more money on that than they do on actual campaigns. Same thing whenever it comes to distribution of capital. Whenever you're talking about, oh, corporations, I mean, why does it matter whether corporations give people money or not in a society that's much more equitable? Because then you have actual checks against each other. What your problem is, Dhruv, and what you're getting at, which I think is important, is that the distribution of capital is such that the amount of money to be raised is concentrated amongst the group of an elite few, and that by changing that, you might be able to then change the campaign system. So look, focus on the eye of the prize, which is that we got to focus more on an egalitarian America, because in that, politicians and everybody has more of an incentive in order to cater to everyone instead of the unique few.
When we try to do the discussion around corruption, something I've always been interested in is how do you talk about corruption, how the system is pivoted against a lot of people without just discouraging people. There's a friend of Rising / The Realignment who I recently saw tweet, you know who you are, tweet, quote, "Neera Tanden, I'm out. System's too corrupt. I'm not engaging in politics anymore." I'm like, okay, dude, obviously nothing's going to happen if you literally leave the system. A bigger issue in American politics. I mean, Sagar, you were just talking before we started recording how you had a Instagram post about how few millennials there are in politics. You would have a quicker way to make political change if millennials just voted and engaged. Yeah. That would overwhelm even the most corporate-y of corporate dollars to boomers in Congress. That would just make way more of a distance. So you should ask yourself, if you go around telling people that the system's corrupt, that we can't change it, and if anything happens that isn't to your liking, you should take a step back, what's more likely to happen? What's more likely to happen is the boomers will take over and your voice won't matter, regardless of money.
Yeah, you know why Neera Tanden is going to be working Joe Biden's America? Because Joe Biden won the Democratic primary because Bernie's supposed coalition of students and working people didn't show up to vote. So maybe figure out how to solve that problem. And don't blame Joe Biden for being Joe Biden. He told us all exactly who he was whenever he ran for president. And I think that that's something that the take masters just really haven't internalized. Okay, what's next?
Okay, so everyone, this is a long question. I actually had to cut it down, but it's a very important question, and it illustrates the fact that we really appreciate serious audience feedback from those of you who really put a lot of time into listening to the show. The full length of this question is available in our first issue of Substack, so go check it out there. This is from Thomas. "Hey guys, I look forward to Tuesdays and Thursdays as I get to listen to new episodes of The Realignment on my drive to work. Although I don't agree with all of your guests or your political beliefs, I find myself learning new every time I tune in. I'm grateful for all the episodes you guys post regularly. Quick note, whenever you get an email like this, you just know that it's not good when someone starts out by saying nice things to us. I just remember reading this on my iPhone. I'm like, okay, something's coming. He also had Scott Galloway show in the subject line, so it clearly was not leading to a good place. However, there's always a however, I found yesterday's episode with Scott Galloway to be an exception. I understand that Mr. Galloway is a very accomplished person. However, it is an immense struggle to make it through an episode with him. Despite your brand of populist politics, I think that something you are both consistently off about are the corona lockdowns. It seems to be your opinion that even if they are inconvenient, there's nothing that money can't fix. Any objections pertaining to government overreach and philosophical questions are also overlooked. This may explain your inability to push back on Mr. Galloway's hyper-privileged take on the US's failed coronavirus response. I can't help but think that if it were his bank account and career that were impacted, if he weren't able to work as a professor, write his books, and run an online business from the comfort of his home office, he would be singing an entirely different tune. His cavalier attitude towards those lives and livelihoods that have been curtailed by state and local governments this past year is so emblematic of the problem our country faces. It's not that Americans don't believe in science, as Mr. Galloway stated, it's that people across the country are being told to take huge hits to their pocketbook and their quality of life by people whose social and economic status shield them from nearly all negative consequences of coronavirus-related measures. Exit polls from the presidential election found coronavirus to be a significantly smaller concern for the average voter than we were led to believe by our pundit class, ourselves included, to be honest. I hope that you and Sagar can begin to push back on any guests who treat the issue with as little nuance and as much hyperbole as Mr. Galloway did.
Wow. Great question, Thomas. And I think one just general note on interviewing style, we're not really like pushback people in that way. And so if somebody says something egregiously wrong, I'm going to be like, okay, you know, but look, I'm a host and it's my opportunity in order to platform different guests. I generally don't agree with a lot of the things that they say, but it's important to maintain a flow of conversation, not just from my perspective, but for yours, for the comfort of your listening. So don't assume that if I just sit here and don't say anything, that I just agree with that person. That being said, I actually generally agree. And I mean, if you go and you look back and listen to what we were talking about, I push back for exactly that reason. I mean, I generally believe that there is absolutely no situation in this country where you should go bankrupt because of the coronavirus pandemic and that the government owes restitution to its citizens for staying home and for not doing anything. And that it is from a point of privilege that I believe that a lot of deficit hawks and other people who are like, let X businesses fail or whatever, are coming from. And that's something that's been consistent through my commentary for the last year, if you want to go back and look at it. And the other thing that you mentioned, which I think is a fair point, I mean, we don't really, again, because we don't get into the culture stuff here on this podcast, yeah, I mean, some of the restrictions on these like churches or restrictions on other gatherings, while you can buy weed and booze and you can go and like protest or whatever, is incredibly hypocritical. But if you want takes like that, go watch Rising. Don't listen to The Realignment.
That's funny. Look, the key thing here, to Sagar's point, is just the idea that I'm not in here to have a debating show or talk to interesting people. That's cool. And that's why we included this in our episode today and in the newsletter, because it's important that our audience get that sort of pushback. It was very well written and very accurate. But yeah, if we had more time with Scott Galloway, I would have pointed out that what I wish people like him were more aware of, because I'm much more to the center, and I think a lot of people who are sort of pushing back from that direction are, is that I wish Professor Galloway were more humble in recognizing that it's one thing for him to say, hey, why don't Americans treat this like World War II? Or, hey, why don't Americans believe in science about COVID-19? Why don't we just accept that these businesses are going to fail? Without also recognizing that he just doesn't have the credibility to state that. We don't live in a US where the elite of the country can just declare things. This isn't World War II. I think that this is a World War II level threat to the country, to the world economy, but you can't act as if our governing class has the same amount of trust, credibility, or ability to actually affect change in the same way the World War II elite was. Obviously, FDR's legacy is a complicated one, but FDR and the people who were running the Ford factories, who didn't produce a single new car for 3 years because they were building tanks and B-24s and all of the armaments that literally saved the world from Nazism, they were incredibly competent. They were incredibly legitimate. And if FDR and the Ford company of the 40s are telling me to take something seriously, I'm going to listen. And that's true for the vast majority of the American people. Today's elite, especially the elite that Professor Galloway is a part of, and in many ways Sagar that we're a part of, we don't have the same amount of credibility. And that's something that especially older 50-something people, no offense, Scott, that's something they're going to have to sort of reconcile themselves with. You can't just go around acting as if I'm just making a neutral call for national service. Why aren't you agreeing with me? You have to accept that that America is gone. It's going to take a while. And frankly, projects like ours to build audiences and build sets of people who even want to have that conversation.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, which is, look, there's not a level of elite trust that there was in the 1940s. And frankly, there shouldn't be after what a lot of these people have pulled. And if Galloway wants something like that to happen, building a more trust trusting, egalitarian society that is capable of understanding each other's cultural nuances and positions and things like that, and capable of litigating and having compromises in American politics, is the first solution so that whenever you have a crisis, you can actually do something like what he suggested. Next question from Sarah. What office do you think an ordinary person, someone with no formal political experience, should run for in order to have the most impact on labor class lives, specifically in a swing state? Well, that's a great question. What do you think, Marshall?
It's an excellent question. You should run for the state legislature. It depends on your state, but often there's a state house or a state senate. You should run for some form of municipal council or even city council, because many of the economic issues that we're interested in, from a minimum wage to tax credits to specific policies even relating to the coronavirus, those are decided at the local level. Something I appreciate about your sort of question is that you're focusing on what's going to make a difference at a very sort of local level. One of the things that we talk about in the culture war context, we could really sum this episode up as culture wars, yay or nay. One of the worst effects of the culture war, however, is that it forces people to only think in a national political context. So instead of thinking about, hey, if I'm really interested in worker rights or wages or even other economic policies, those are going to be on your local level. They have nothing to do with AOC. They have nothing to do with Madison Cawthorn. President Trump not only doesn't have an opinion on them, but he couldn't do anything about them if he did. That's something key. So really focus on that local aspect.
Yeah, it's a very important question. And state legislature and city council are actually the ones that matter most. It depends on whether you're in a big city or in your more rural slash suburban area. So if you're suburban slash rural, state legislature for sure. They have huge amounts of impact in the amount of commerce that is regulated within their state, in terms of which grants go to different companies. Lots of impact there in terms of where you live and the labor class for your state. Now, if you live in a big city, city council can have the same amount of thing. Look at that Amazon deal that was in New York City. That was a city council thing. Go and look up how Amazon gets harassed by a lot of people on the Seattle City Council. Same thing with Microsoft. Same thing if you look at the San Francisco regulatory bodies. City government matters so much if you live in a large urban area. And I 100% think this is where nationalization of politics is so bad, because it stops us from having real conversations about that. Now, national politics is still going to govern a huge amount of your lives, especially in coronavirus times and more. But we have to remember who exactly regulates commerce in this country. It's not just the Department of Commerce. You all have a lot more say than people think.
Last question from Edward. Given that China will soon have enough influence in most institutions, political parties, businesses, media, and academia in Western countries, will this, and should this, lead to greater state funding, control, / ownership of those institutions by Western governments? What do you think?
I wish, Edward. Here's the real answer. No. And you know why? Because of what did I talk about previously in the Citizens United question about distribution of capital and about who has more power. Now, increased Chinese influence in American business is going to be largely directly correlated, I think, with a lesser push in order to actually make any of these restrictions cumbersome on American institutions, which are flirting with the Chinese, whether it be capital, whether it be culture, and so much more. But if there was ever an opening, it's right now. And the reason why is because the Chinese massively overplayed their hand with coronavirus. You can go and take a look at Pew Research polling. The entire world now has almost a 2/3 negative view of the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese government. There has never been a better time in order to capitalize on that legitimate feeling, I believe, in order to push back against these forces of capital. In terms of the Biden administration, I don't know how this is going to go. He's got a guy who's working for him named Jake Sullivan, who's going to be his national security advisor. He's actually somebody who's great on China, who's talked a lot about this. His other foreign policy instincts have not generally been good. But the one good thing about Biden is he doesn't really believe in anything. He's kind of just like a guy who's like, oh, well, you know, we'll get it done and compromise and all that. Sometimes not great, but sometimes actually it could work. And so if there's one area where Trump changed the discourse in American politics forever, it's China. So maybe, just maybe, Biden will capitalize that as president.
This is a great place to end because my take here is more positive than it usually is on the realignment. I actually don't fear this end game as much as the question suggests. Let's go category by category. Academia, what was the number one way that the Chinese Communist Party engaged itself in academia? It was through Confucius Institutes. Confucius Institutes were sort of the height of naive America and China both peacefully rise together and everything's fun and dandy. That's what they were. They were institutions that were run by the Chinese that were actually on American campuses. A lot of them are closing. A lot of schools, whether they're in blue states, red states, swing states, are not comfortable holding them anymore because of the requirements that they impose on the institutions, everything from Hong Kong to Taiwan to Tibet. The discourse has completely changed there. Also, if we're looking at the FBI in a very nonpartisan senses, recent crackdown on American academics who are taking illicit money from the Chinese government, that's been a huge thing. And that's frankly something that's going to continue under the Biden administration. Now, we should be concerned that schools such as Harvard were having this huge set of issues, and MIT, for example. But the fact that the FBI is doing this and the fact that there wasn't any actual pushback to this fact shows, to your point, Sagar, that the pendulum has really just swung on this sort of thing. There really could have been a world, and I think this goes to your point as well, about how the Chinese overplayed their hand during COVID, or this was sort of labeled, once again, Donald Trump as being a xenophobe and cracking down on people who try to work across borders because we're all global citizens. No, no one said that. That it's not 2007. It's not 2013. It's 2020. And this really is where this huge opening is. And then as we're speaking to the other issues, you know, I don't think the Chinese have any influence within the Democratic or Republican parties. I think there are individual actors that are a problem, but because of the fact that you can't actually donate foreign money, because I don't really believe that that foreigners have the ability to literally swing elections, I don't fear the political party part. And then when it comes to media and business, I understand how there's a serious threat of Western businesses and media organizations getting compromised when they enter the Chinese market, but I don't see the problem going the other direction as much, except when we're talking about Hollywood and media specifically. So for example, everyone knows the story of how in Top Gun 2, a Chinese company, I think it was Tencent Pictures, used its control over the financing to make certain anti-Taiwan statements in the, not statements, but make certain anti-Taiwan moves in the movie. That's not great. Part of the way that we could do things like this is we could restrict the percentage of ownership that Chinese companies take in American media corporations. There's a variety of ways we do this. We already do this in areas like airlines. For example, as I understand it, foreign companies and firms and individuals could only take a very limited percent of equity in any sort of American aviation firm. I think we should probably expand that to other industries and other regions as well. But Chinese obviously implement this sort of policy. It makes sense in our context as well.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I mean, this is where things are boring but matter. And I hope, like I said, I really hope that the power of the executive is used to marshal towards these goals. Anyway, it's been a great episode with all of you. It's been a very fun conversation. Maybe a little spicier than usual. We'll try and keep it that way. Largely a coffee intake thing on my end. But we thank you all very much for listening. We're going to have a great episode for you over on Thursday.
And as we mentioned, our Substack is a great forum for not only asking us questions, giving us longer responses like the one we featured today, and actually commenting on each other's work. Once again, we're trying to build a community here. So please go to realignment.substack.com to subscribe. And as always, a huge thank you to the Lincoln Network for the support of the show. We really appreciate it. We'll see you on Thursday.